Today, we have 158 of 161 members. Furman will be absent Saturday only, as Pryor will be. In the audience, we have three delegates from New Brunswick's Commission on Legislative Democracy, including Deputy Minister David McLaughlin. David, are you there? We also have visiting with us today Patrick Fournier of the University of Montreal. A guest every weekend, as you know, is Ken McKinnon, Commissioner of the Yukon, and Linda Johnson, Deputy Chief Electoral Officer, Elections BC. Before announcements, are there any questions? I was once taught to count to 10 before you close the question period off. Then we go to some announcements. We all know, by the way, or some know, that last night the Canucks lost. Martha Stewart lost. The good news, I'm told, is that the Prince George Cougars won over the Vancouver Giants. And Doug says the most important thing about that is the Cougars goalie actually, I mean, the goalie made a goal himself, so it must have been a great night.
Jack, we want to clarify, Don McLaughlin, the goalie, scored on the Vancouver team. That's what happened.
Dick Hall, he wants to make a couple of very brief comments about the barbershop group.
Is it on? Never ask a minister to give a brief comment.
That's why I said brief.
And this place is really exciting me because I never felt such great love as I feel here. I'm almost tempted to just pass a plate.
That's a good idea.
I want my comment is just a correction. You have Astana's barbershop on your notice, and we're not, because barbershop cannot mix men and women together. And what pleases me here is that we're half and half, half women and half men, and I think that's the biggest statement that I can see in this assembly. We're going to have to correct our situation politically, but we're also going to have to correct some of the words in the national anthem. I was told last night that there's some words there that aren't cricket in today's language. So anyway, so thank you very much for listening to us.
Thanks for organizing it. You'll have to see Chuck Walker's new cartoons. This one features Kathy and Christine. He's captured, I think, the personalities quite well. And they might not agree. Well, people say he captured mine in the first one. I didn't agree with that, but that's what cartoonists do. And there's another cartoon there about quickets, and of course it's quite subtle. So there's a kind of a test there as to whether you get that cartoon. Lil Brulhart, she has an announcement. Lil, where are you? Lil.
This is just a reminder to all of those who signed up to attend the theater tonight. Because tonight is the only night that we can have our informal discussions with the Farrell Group, the theater tonight has been canceled. We'll do it another time. Thanks for signing up.
Thanks, Lil. And another announcement. This was announced at breakfast, but for those who were not there, if your discussion group says Somerville Room, forget that. You're going to the concourse downstairs. The only reason you might want to go to the Somerville Room, if you want to be surrounded by 12 dentists, then you can go to the Somerville Room. Other than that, go to the concourse. And we've announced in the newsletter several birthdays, six or seven birthdays around this time, but we actually have someone who's having a birthday today, George Boucher. George is having his 41st today. Try 62. Well, if I would look that good. Very briefly on our evaluation from last week, you all do these evaluation forms. You spend 10 or 15, 20 minutes on them, and let me briefly give you some of the results. Quite astonishingly, the overall grade, you know, that you give yourselves, because basically you are evaluating yourselves and all of us together, is actually inched up a little bit over the previous four. So it has gone up every week from the 4 weeks. I'm only talking about decimal 0.01, but still it has gone up. The four highest grades were given to, I'm looking forward to the next session. About 97% of the respondents gave that a complete five. Secondly, I feel the work of the Citizens' Assembly is important. About 95% of the people rated that the highest mark. And what is very encouraging, of course, is the discussion group leaders, the facilitators, keep on getting very, very high marks. And this time they zoomed up ahead again. A lot of high satisfaction with our facilitators. There they are all up there. Let's give our facilitators a... And lastly, of course, and not unimportantly, for Christine, Kathy, and all the staff, you rate the staff very, very high. So those are the four high marks. I want to just quickly take a few of the what you like best and least out of your comments, out of 170 or so that we got. One is that, quote, I noticed this weekend that everybody was laughing a lot. Quote, the commitment I see from everyone is growing, even though it was high to begin with. Lots of positive comments about the discussion groups. 20, 30, 40 at least people indicated really, really like the discussion groups and how the facilitators are doing. Several indicated some information. They wanted some information about the profile of the province, the demographics of the province, and we're going to respond to that. And David Baxter, next time we meet, will give us a profile of the province. Also, several said, I'm struggling with Saturday after lunch sleepiness, and we need to take a nap or a walk. So we want to tell you that we're listening to you, and we've extended the lunch hour by 15 minutes. So you've got 15 minutes to take a power nap or a power walk. So when you come here at 1:15, we expect everybody to be bright, and we're going to have the sleeping police check everything. And lastly, one person said with a great big exclamation mark, Coke instead of Pepsi, please. Well, these are serious matters. And then the next person I read said, don't get rid of Pepsi for Coke. Now, why are these ratings so high? I indicated that I've got my seven reasons that I, when I asked to speak for about 20 minutes, there's seven reasons why the members of the Assembly are rating this so high. Last week, I indicated my number one reason. And that was, I think, that in our selection process, we probably underestimated the importance of self-selection. That self-selection step was incredibly important. The randomness, of course, gave us independence and representativeness, but the self-selection, where 17 out of 200 said, yes, I'm going to do it, we all get very heavily committed people. The second reason why I believe you'll get these, before we finish, you see, by in December, you'll get my seven reasons. The second reason why I believe it has been so successful is because of the way you answered that one question. What I'm doing is important. Everybody here feels, senses it, that they're in something, they're involved in something that is really, really important. This isn't an assignment that the government has created where you're giving advice to the government, where they will take your recommendation and put it on the shelf or revise it or maybe say we'll look at it next year. This is where we have 160 members, 161 members of BC, randomly then self-selected, who will come to a judgment, whose decision will finally go to the people of BC. This has never been done before. And that's why you feel it is so important, because it is important. And that is one of the strongest reasons, I believe, for this Assembly's success. It really is, as we say, it sounds almost cliche, but it really is power to the people. So, given that, I am now very pleased, unless there's still someone who has a burning question to ask. We're going to move then to the learning session, and I'm very pleased to ask Ken Carty to introduce David Farrell.
Thank you, Jack. Anybody recognize this book? Do we have a test? Well, we're not going to have a test this morning, but we're going to have something much better. We're going to have the author of it talk to us about some really important questions. And David Farrell, it's a treat to have him here. He is the Jean Monnet Professor of European Politics at the University of Manchester. And that's a very wonderful title because Jean Monnet was really the genius behind the whole creation of the idea of a united Europe. And so to have a professorship that's named in his honor, I think, is a distinct privilege, but I think it also reflects on the enormous admiration and respect that David's colleagues have for him. He's a graduate of a university in his home country of Ireland, and then he did graduate work in Florence in Italy at the European University Institute. He's had visiting appointments at the University of California and at the Harvard Kennedy School, at the Australian National University, and as chairman of something called the McDougall Trust in England, which is an organization that's been there for some decades now, committed to the study of electoral systems and debate around issues of electoral reform. Tells me he's just finished a book on Australian electoral systems. Isn't quite out yet, but will be soon, and I know that you'll all probably want to order that book and read several hundred pages on Australian preferential voting. He will. This is very exciting stuff, I tell you. Just finished co-authoring a major and important book called Political Parties and Advanced Industrial Democracies, which provides the first really modern, recent analysis of what's happening to political parties in the contemporary world. He is, of course, the author of the best-selling textbook, Electoral Systems. Today he's going to talk to us on choosing electoral systems. David, welcome.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you very much, and I'm very grateful. Is the sound all right as I speak, yeah? I'm very grateful for this invitation. We have this phrase in Britain, in my adopted country, anoraks. I don't know if any of you have heard of this term, an anorak. But basically, an anorak is normally conceived of as a person who wears an anorak, a long coat, who stands on railway platforms. If ever you've traveled in England, you might have seen them. They're on railway platforms watching the trains go by, drinking their flasks of coffee and little notebooks in their hand. And all they're doing for hours and hours during the day is taking note of the trains as they go by. So they're collecting train numbers. Well, in the profession of political science, there's a couple of people who are also given the title anoraks, and Campbell and Ken and Elizabeth, as you're going to hear from later on, and myself, would be in that category. Our interest, we sort of have a secret handshake, if you like. We go to political science conventions, and our interest is in getting information on electoral systems, the sort of thing that really doesn't interest an awful lot of other people. So I have to say, watching you over the last couple of weeks, because I have been probably one of your most avid audiences, it's kind of bizarre. I was your audience, and now you're my audience today. But I've been watching you on the website. It's given me great pleasure. I mean, basically, all I want to say is thank you for this invitation. I'm very honored to be here, and you've made one anorak very, very happy indeed. Now, I was given a brief by Ken and Campbell that I was to look at the question of choosing electoral systems. And as I've understood the brief, what I'm here to try and do is to set some context, to try and look at the BC process in terms of a context of other places, other countries, other regions in countries that have changed their electoral systems. Now, as you can imagine, that's quite a big brief. In fact, to prepare for this lecture, I read two books by another colleague, Sarah Birch, who's just looked at this question in terms of new democracies. So it's an extremely big area, and I can only really touch on a few themes in the time I've got available. But basically, what I want to try and do is look at the following five questions. I want to very briefly set the scene by looking at electoral systems and change, how electoral systems have changed, what's been going on in the last 15 years, 20 years or so. I then want to spend perhaps the bulk of my time in sections 2 and 3 of the presentation looking first of all at electoral system change in just the post-communist democracies of Eastern Central Europe, and even only in this case some of them. I can't look at all of them, there are so many. Then electoral system reform in some of the established democracies, and then rounding off a bit more briefly sections 4 and 5 of the presentation, we'll look at the sort of the general question that is around the issue of how you choose an electoral system and whether electoral systems that have been chosen in the last 10, 15 years have worked as expected. I'll say a few words about that. So let's get on with the first of these questions, electoral systems and change. The first point really to say here is that for a very long time there wasn't an awful lot to say or see. There was no point in writing the sort of book that you've been reading, the book that I wrote a few years ago, because there really wasn't a lot going on. I mean, we're dealing in essence with virtually no cases of electoral reform in the established democracies. I think France was probably the only exception, but France is an exception in almost all respects, as you may imagine. But apart from France, very few established democracies ever entertained the idea of changing their electoral systems. there were hardly any new democracies. We'd had the post-Second World War, post-colonization rush, so we had some new democracies setting up in the 40s and 50s. But as we get into the 70s, 80s, and 90s, well, 70s and 80s, I suppose, there aren't that many new democracies. And in essence, the literature on electoral systems was really rather tiny. There were about two or three books out there, and that was it. So there was not a lot to write about, and there was not a lot being written about. Now, that's all changed, and changed extremely dramatically and extremely suddenly. Now we have a lot of new democracies, right across Eastern Central Europe, the former Soviet Union, across Latin America, across parts of Africa, and even in my own European Union, it's become a democracy, or it's becoming a democracy. So a lot of cases of new electoral systems being developed for new democratic systems. We've had a lot more experimentation with electoral reform in established democracies. Democracies that have been around in some cases for a very, very long time indeed. And I'll be coming to some examples of that later on. And then we've also had experimentation with new kinds of electoral systems. You know, electoral systems that really weren't all that prominent before. Now, let me give you a flavour of that. And I'm guessing you already know a bit about that from the lectures from Ken and Campbell earlier on in your deliberations. But if we look at the five main families of electoral systems, you've been through these all, the plurality, the majority, the list, the STV, the single transferable vote, and the mixed systems. Just to see the constellation, the way in which these systems are used across the world's democracies today. So this is a summary picture of what's going on today in the world's various democracies. The supporters of the first-past-the-post system, the British system, the system you're using at present, are always very happy whenever I show that slide, because it suggests that it's an extremely popular system. 52% of the world's population are electing their politicians under that system. Of course, India is a big factor there, because India is so huge. So we can moderate that slightly by just looking at the trends in terms of the proportion of countries, regardless of the size of the countries. Now, as you can see, my own beloved single transferable vote, I'm Irish, I was born, bred and buttered on that system. It's obviously the system I feel a greatest affinity to, is not exactly doing very well in those trends. Ireland and Malta are the only two countries that use the single transferable vote. But why I put this up is for that reason, the mixed systems. Before the 1990s, there was one country that used that system, Germany, only one country. And had only been using that system after the Second World War. Now, as you can see, regardless of how you cut your cake, over a quarter of the world's legislators are elected by some version of that system. So that, in itself, suggests something very dramatic has been going on. I'm not meaning to suggest that this is the system we all have to rush to, because others have been rushing to. I'm just drawing your attention to the fact that it definitely is a system that's much, much in fashion. All right, let's get to the main gist of what I need to talk to you about. I said I was going to, first of all, try and deal a bit with the new democracies, the design of electoral systems in new democracies, and here focusing on the post-communist democracies of Eastern Central Europe. So let's do this in terms of three main themes. I want to look at the context of the change. I want to look at the decision-making processes, the sort of thing that you're doing here, and then I want to briefly outline some of the principal issues. That's what I'm going to do here. So let's take these each in turn. Let's start with the context of the change in these post-communist democracies. Well, first of all, you're dealing with what can be roughly called a zero-stage reform, a tabula rasa, a completely blank sheet. You're dealing with, ultimately, a new democracy. So there's this wonderful opportunity in these cases for them to design things from scratch. Now, having said that, they have to do this rather quickly. This is, the late 1980s, the early 1990s. Things have to move on. And so what you tend to find in some of these cases, and I'm going to be showing you examples in a few minutes of these cases, is that shortcuts are taken. And in some cases, what they tend to do is dust off the old legislation in those cases where there were democracies before the post-war communist takeover and revert back to type, revert back to those kind of systems. So there was some evidence of shortcuts. There was a focus on contestation, not participation. What I'm getting at there is that you are dealing with reasonably established political institutions in the sense that the voters, the citizens of these countries had always voted. Long before democracy came around, they'd always voted. The problem was they had no choice. They could all just tick the box saying, yes, of course we support the Communist Party. And 99.9% of them always did that because that was the right thing to do. So they had already structures of participation, systems of participation in place. What they had to focus on was the system, was how to focus on contestation, how to develop an electoral system that would incorporate new parties. And here we're already beginning to see signs of competing elites. The communist elites, for example, the former communist elites, are very much trying to direct attention towards non-proportional systems because they calculate that they will benefit more from a non-proportional system. The new emerging elites, the non-communist elites, are saying, no, we want proportional representation because that's the only way we're going to get into the parliament in the first place. So competition is already beginning to come in. But for the most part, the parties are weakly institutionalized. Apart from the former communist parties, there aren't, on the whole, a lot of other parties yet out there. They're not going to be out there until they've been elected for the first time. So we really are, as I said, dealing with a zero stage. And there's a lot of uncertainty over outcomes. There's uncertainty, I know, in your process about the outcome. If you pick a system, do we really know how it's going to work? Well, they have that multiplied. How do we really, really know how the voters are going to react in the very first contested election that they're going to be using this new system in? So the context is very particular and in very many respects a different context to the context that you're facing here. The decision-making processes, how do these sort of pan out? Well, for the most part, there was quite a wide list of actors. It wasn't just the party leaders or the people who had ambitions to become MPs in the newly elected parliament. They weren't the only actors who were involved in this process. You had other agents. You had constitutional courts who were very much engaged in making sure that the system was going to look good. You might have had presidents. Lech Wałęsa in Poland was a very prominent player in designing the Polish system, much to the annoyance of the parliament because Wałęsa had this tendency to keep changing his mind, it seemed, and really trying to force the issue. But in essence, it was quite a complex process because you had a wide list of actors. It was a very inclusive, well, let me correct that. It was a somewhat inclusive process. What I mean by that was that there were cases where they had round tables, where you had elite, middle-level elite, a small grouping of elite, you know, people who would eventually emerge as leaders of political parties, who would be able to debate the process. Now, that's at least a little bit better than just having the system designed by the establishment. There was some opening up of the elite. And indeed, in one case that I know of, in Slovenia, there was at least some reference to the voters. I don't have all the details, unfortunately, about how much reference there was. So the decision-making process was somewhat more complex than it would have been at the turn of the last century in the first wave democracies of Britain and France and across continental Europe. It was a little bit more complex than that. And because of that, what you tended to find was compromise. Because the decision-making process was that little bit more complex, you got a little bit more compromise coming in. So you had people weighing up, you know, constituency representation versus proportional representation, all of that kind of thing. And this is, if for no other reason, one of the main reasons why mixed systems tended to come into the fray because of the need to compromise people's wishes. So I said I was going to deal with context, decision-making processes, and issues. What about the sort of issues that tended to come up? Well, the issues tended to break down into three main types. One was the sense that you had to help nurture the development of political parties. So there was almost an air of altruism here in the sense that they weren't necessarily trying to say we want to protect the interests of this party or these two or three big parties. There was a sort of general sense that we want to try and nurture the development of political parties for good reasons, because until the first election, it's very difficult for a putative party leader to be able to predict how he or she is going to do, how his or her party is going to do. So let's help them all and hope that we benefit ultimately from this. There was a sense of feeling that you need to facilitate minorities. It sort of follows on from that. It might be ethnic minorities, or it might be just regional minorities, that you had to have an electoral system that might give them some sense of getting into the system, some ease of getting into the system. And there was also some question marks over the nature of parliamentary representation. What kind of MP did we want to produce with our electoral system? That there was sort of some questions over that. Now, how did that pan out? in terms of the electoral systems that were designed? Well, as I said, this is not all of the countries, but this is certainly a good representative sample of most of them. These are the first electoral systems in the late 1980s, early 1990s, that were adopted in all of those countries. And I just draw your attention to a few things here. I mean, first of all, on the issue of whether they were trying to help minorities to get into the system, I think that's shown quite well by the fact that only three cases, in only three countries of that list there, did they go for a majoritarian system, which is roughly the French runoff system. And as you'll have heard, as you'll have seen in the earlier presentations, of course, a majoritarian system is a non-proportional system. So apart from those three cases, all of the other countries went for a system that had some element of proportionality in it to try and help minorities, at least some minorities, win seats. And I just draw your attention, of course, I have to, given my Irish ancestry, to the big excitement of Estonia. There was an Estonian political scientist who works as a professor in the University of California, Irvine, called Rein Taagepera, and he designed the system. And this caused a huge excitement for us all, because now we had three countries, as well as Ireland and Malta, that used this system. Unfortunately, as you'll see in a minute, this experiment in Estonia was not to last. All right, well, that's one way in which you can see from the systems that there was an effort to facilitate the interests of minorities. You can also see from these same systems a sense that they needed to design, or they felt the need to design a parliament that would have a particular kind of parliamentary representation. What I'm getting at here is, well, as you'll have noticed, there's quite a lot of list electoral systems there, and I know you know this, that if you have certain types of list systems, there's very little scope for individual MPs, with individual constituents, and looking after the needs of the constituents and nursing the district and chasing personal votes. Well, when you look through those list systems, a large number of those were what we call preferential list systems. So the politicians were chasing personal votes on those lists. They were not closed lists. So even in the case of list systems, there was clearly an impression being given that they expected the parliamentarians to work the constituencies, work the regions. And as you can see, a lot of the other systems are mixed systems, so you're going to have single-member constituency representation there. SDV, of course, is in there present, and the majoritarian systems are constituency-based systems. And in fact, when you look at it, there are only four cases of closed list systems in that big sample of countries. So there's only four cases where they clearly were going for a style of parliamentary representation which was not focused on direct links with the voters, if I could put it like that. So Bosnia, Moldova, Romania, and Yugoslavia are really quite exceptional in that list. Now that's the situation at the start. That's the situation in and around the early 1990s. The story then gets quite complex after that, and I can't go into that, but basically change comes into play. Politicians are now elected. They've learned how the system works. The voters certainly are beginning to learn how the systems work. And politicians start doing what politicians do, which is they start thinking about whether the system is right for them and right for the politicians. So we get to a stage of subsequent reforms. So those systems, in some cases, don't remain fixed in place. They start to change. And let me just say a little bit about the context here. In the first instance, what you do get is what we could call an element of stickiness getting into the system. What I mean by that is that once you've got a system up and running, inevitably it becomes difficult to change it. So in a lot of these cases, they do remain the same system overall. So there is some element of stickiness. But against that, the counterweight is vested interests have started to form. The political elite has started to develop and see themselves as the political elite. There's been lesson learning. They've seen some of the errors that have creeped into the system, errors as they would see it, that they would like to try and fix. For example, the communist elites. Earlier on, I mentioned how if anything, the communist elites wanted to have non-proportional systems because they felt that was the best way to stop competitors breaking through. Well, they suddenly discover that, in fact, things aren't working quite so well as they had hoped electorally. So suddenly the communist elites become converts. Proportional representation actually isn't so bad. So they're beginning to entertain the idea of changing the system. And then also you have a realization that when you have non-proportional systems, it's quite difficult to form coalition governments. You get single-party governments, and single-party governments in the context of a newly developing democracy is not necessarily ideal. You might want a coalition government. So change starts coming. And the change is there. These are the cases that have all changed. So all the majoritarian systems disappear. They all become mixed systems. My beloved single transferable vote also falls, by the way. It becomes a list system. And some of the mixed systems become list systems. So basically what everybody does is and this is the case for all of the Central and Eastern European post-communist democracies, not just these countries, they all converge on one of two systems, the list family of systems or the mixed family of systems. What I'll add as one little bit of extra detail here is that in the case of those mixed systems, they are almost all what we would call the mixed member majoritarian or the parallel system, the system that is not fully proportional. The only cases of something closer to the German model of a proportional mixed member system are Albania and to some extent Hungary. So apart from Albania and roughly Hungary, all the other cases are what we call the majoritarian systems. I can obviously go into that in the questions later if you want. Now, this is a summary of the situation at the start and at the finish. Don't get the impression from this that that's all that happened. Because in the detail, you had some of those countries which changed two or three times. And there was a lot of change going on here. And that in itself is a lesson, I think, about, you know, you go ahead and you make a process for electoral reform. Well, how do you make sure that process of electoral reform is allowed to last and bed in and have some chance of success? Another feature of lesson learning by the new elite was how they were going to try and make the system a little bit more difficult for other parties to break through. How they were going to try and sort of close off the micro parties and the tiny new parties that inevitably form in new democracies. And you can see this from this evidence. This is the use of what we call legal thresholds, and I'm sure you've heard about these. These are minimum votes that a party is required to have before it's allowed to have any seats. So in Bulgaria, a party needed to get at least 4% of the vote before it was given any seats. And that meant that really tiny parties didn't pick up any seats. So it's a way of dampening down the proportionality of an electoral system. But it's also a way of control, you know, for the elite to control things, to make it just that little bit more difficult for parties to get in. And as you can see, already in the first election, countries had moved down this road of adopting legal thresholds. Well, they really went for a big time by the end of the decade. Almost all of them now have legal thresholds. Some of them have increased the legal threshold. None of them have reduced the legal threshold. And in some cases, they've even added extra little wrinkles, so that if you wanted to have a couple of small party leaders wanted to form a joint list, they had an even bigger threshold to pass. And that's what's suggested by the asterisks. So clearly, they're making life very, very, very difficult for micro parties, in that sense. So I give you just a flavour now in the next slide of what that means in terms of the type of political system that's produced. And I stress this is just a flavour. I don't want to go into this in too much detail because I'm guessing this is not something you really want to hear too much about now. But this is breaking down all those countries in terms of whether they're list or mixed. And as you can see, average disproportionality, that's the average overall level of disproportionality in the system. The average distortion, in other words, between the proportion of votes that a party gets and the proportion of seats. And the higher that index, the higher the level of disproportionality, the more disproportional, the less proportional that system is. So 6.7, 8.6, that's very high. I mean, if you compare it with the Netherlands, an established democracy in Western Europe, where disproportionality is 1 or 2%, it's quite a big difference. And the average number of parliamentary parties is sort of a weighted figure. To try and explain this, I suppose, the best way is to think about the system I know best, the British system. The British Parliament, the British House of Commons, has 9 or 10 parties in it. Conservatives, Labour, Liberal Democrat, Plaid Cymru, Scottish Nationalist, Ulster Unionist, Democratic Unionist, SDLP, Sinn Féin, etc., etc. So there's a lot of parties in the British Parliament. But we all know, when any of us who look at politics in Britain, that it's really two big parties, the Conservatives or Labour. So we have to think of some way of attaching weights to take account of the respective size of the different parties. And so in Britain, roughly speaking, it's a sort of a 2.7 party system according to the average number of parliamentary parties when you apply this index that is behind all this. So what we're seeing here is that you have multi-party systems. Once you get above three, average number of parliamentary parties above three, you have, in essence, a multi-party system. And what that suggests to me at a quick glance is they probably have the balance about right. They've got quite a high level of disproportionality, which is produced by the illegal thresholds, among other things. But they clearly still have a lot of parties in there. And clearly there has been a reasonably good balance going on there. And for a new democracy, that's probably no bad thing. That doesn't necessarily be the sort of thing you want to achieve in an established democracy like here in BC. Now, that's all I want to say about the new democracies. I want to move on and look at the question of electoral system reform in established democracies. And I can obviously, in questions if you want, I can go back over some of the material I've introduced you to now. So let's look at the question of change in established democracies, because as I said at the very beginning, apart from France, there really wasn't an awful lot to talk about. And even in the case of France, it wasn't terribly interesting. Well, what we've seen is quite a transformation. In 1984, a well-known German political scientist, Dieter Nolan, made the Italian phrase that electoral reform occurs only in extraordinary historical circumstances. Nobody disputed that, because that was a fact. So as recently as the late 1980s, Nolan's dictum, as it became known as, applied. You know, France, as I said, fiddled around, but basically there wasn't fundamental change in France. There were very, very few exceptions to that norm. And then suddenly, it all changes. It all changes at the national level in New Zealand, Italy, Japan, Venezuela, and Israel. All of them changed their electoral systems. I know Venezuela, those of you who follow the recent news events might wonder why I've got Venezuela in there, whether it really is a democracy. But for a long time, it has been seen as one of the more long-term democracies in Latin America. And it changed its system in the early 1990s. And then we've also had regional electoral reform. We've had some in the United States, as we're seeing now. We're having some across Canada. And we've also had some in Britain. And so what I want to do in this section of the presentation is spend a bit of time looking at electoral reform at national level in three of the established democracies, New Zealand, Italy, and Japan. And then I want to deal briefly with the British case, because I think the British case introduces some interesting features that would be worth taking on board as you continue with your deliberations. So let's just deal with the national level change in our three democracies. First of all, I'll start with New Zealand. Now, I'm going to deal with this quite briefly, because I'm well aware of the fact that Elizabeth McLay later on is going to be talking about New Zealand, and she has a lot more experience about it for obvious reasons than I do. So she's going to say a lot more about it than I can. But I just want to draw your attention to a few things, because it's useful for what I'm doing at this point. What drove the change? What was the catalyst for change? Well, it was sort of a mix of things, but it seemed to boil down to questions to do with the unpopularity of governments. All governments are unpopular, I know, but they were quite unpopular in New Zealand at that stage. Economic recession, and anomalous election results, which I gather is a sort of issue that you've had here in BC, where the party with the most votes wasn't necessarily the party that ended up with the most seats, that kind of thing. So in 1986, a royal commission was established by the New Zealand government to deliberate and consider possible new electoral systems for New Zealand. New Zealand at that stage used the same system you have here, the single-member plurality, the first-past-the-post system. And ultimately, the Royal Commission proposes a mixed system, MMP. And then there's a sort of long phase of prevarication by the politicians. Elizabeth might be able to go into that. But ultimately, it results eventually in a series of referendums. And in 1993, the New Zealand voters in a referendum vote for change, vote for the adoption of the mixed-member system. Italy, our second of three cases. Italy has political scandal. Italy always has political scandal. But it really had bad scandal in the 1980s, the dirty hands or clean hands, I never remember, scandal, when politicians were clearly taking a lot of backhanders, and the ramifications are still being looked at to this very day. The voters were furious. And they had one way of getting their revenge, which is quite unique. Not many countries have this, which is if they're angry enough, the voters can, by petition, force a referendum. So that's exactly what they did. And some very, very smart people worked it out that they could use this referendum in a very particular way. Now, what I should explain is that a referendum in Italy, under this context, cannot change legislation. It can't add any articles to existing acts. Acts of Parliament. All it can do is withdraw clauses in existing legislation. And this is what's called an abrogative, I can never pronounce that word, referendum. So referendum to delete certain clauses. And what these really smart people discovered is that if you remove certain clauses in the details of the electoral law relating to the upper house, the Senate, you could turn it into a mixed system. And that's what they proposed. So Italy at that stage was using a list system, a list electoral system. So in a very successful referendum campaign, the politicians had no control over this. They turned it into a version of the mixed system. Then the politicians realized, well, they've done it for the Senate. They could only do it for the Senate because it was a detail in how the Senate's electoral law had been derived. They couldn't do it for the lower house, the Chamber of Deputies. So the politicians had no choice. It had been changed for the Senate. They had to change it for the lower house because in the Italian system, the two houses of Parliament are more or less of equal power. So they had to change. So the politicians subsequently changed the lower house system in the same way. So Italy is quite fascinating in that sense. But it's important to note, of course, that there were very big restrictions, obviously, on what the voters could do. You know, they couldn't have changed Italy, unfortunately, to a single transferable vote because that was not available to them in terms of how they could delete certain clauses in the legislation. And then finally, Japan. Japan also has its political scandals. In this case, it tends to be more associated with the campaign activities of politicians in the constituencies, so very much at the individual MP level, but pretty severe scandals. So the government party, the LDP party, are forced to react to this. There's such a public outcry. And so in 1989, the government party established an advisory committee. So it's a bit like a round table, but very much an elitist process. And this advisory committee proposed a mixed system. And then we have another process of prevarication. The politicians are doing everything they can to kick this to touch. And then ultimately, because of the formation of a new coalition government with elements in that government who'd never been in government before and, you know, face the prospect they may never get in again under the existing system they used in Japan, they pushed through the reform. So Japan also adopted the mixed system at that stage. So those are the three cases. Now let's spend a bit of time looking at them because there's some quite interesting commonalities there, I think, that's worth sort of dwelling on. So let's just outline some of them here, some of the more obvious ones. Well, we're dealing with the use of referendums. That's kind of interesting in two cases, but for different purposes. In New Zealand, the referendum was at the end of the process. You know, a royal commission proposed a system, and then the voters in New Zealand were given a chance to decide whether that's the system they wanted. In Italy, as you've seen, the referendum was at the very start of the process. The voters forced the hand of the politicians. The role of some kind of commission or committee in two of those cases, in New Zealand and to a degree also in Japan. So what's interesting there is that the politicians to varying degrees have handed the decision-making process over to some other body other than themselves. There's an element of inclusiveness there, but it's quite limited, at least in the Japanese case, I think. All of these changes happen within months of each other. They all happen in the early 1990s. And unfortunately, there hasn't been a lot since then. I mean, I've mentioned Venezuela. They were changed about the same time. Israel changed about the same time. But that's been it. It's been quite quiet, unfortunately, for those of us who like to follow these things. They all started from different starting points. They all started from different beginnings, in the sense that in the case of New Zealand, you were dealing with the single-member plurality, non-proportional system. In the case of Italy, you were dealing with a very proportional system, proportional representation by list. And then Japan was using this very quirky system that is hardly used by anyone now, the single non-transferable vote. I don't even want to explain it. But basically all you need to know of this system is that it was what we could call a semi-proportional system. It's sort of in the middle between the two extremes. So they all start from these different points. And then they all produce roughly the same system. They all produce mixed systems. But even in the detail there, there are some important differences. In fact, of the three cases, only New Zealand adopts a proportional system. It's the only one that adopts the German system. In fact, it comes closest to this day. It's the closest country to the German, the original German model of mixed member proportional. Both Japan and Italy adopt the mixed member majoritarian, the semi-proportional system. And what that means, in effect, is that Japan has really made the least change. I mean, there's some very important changes going on underneath, but basically Japan has gone from semi-proportional to semi-proportional. The interesting cases for our purposes, I think, are Italy and New Zealand. As for the causes, there's some interesting commonalities here. The causes of the change, or I suppose more accurately, I guess, the catalysts for change. And I've only touched on some of these. I haven't had the time to really go into it in sufficient detail. But one of the obvious causes was the phenomenon of electoral change. It's a phenomenon that is universal. It's happening everywhere. What I mean by that is that voters are becoming more fickle. Voters are showing a willingness to change the vote. You vote for one party one time, another party the other. That's a reasonably recent phenomenon. 10, 20 years ago, you didn't have much of that. Everyone voted the same way their father or mother voted, never changed. That was the sort of standard pattern. We have electoral change now. Where you have electoral change, you've got the origins of new parties. It's inevitable. If there's a lot of change going on, then enterprising politicians are going to form new parties because they see their chance of breaking through. So there's pressure. There's a lot of pressure on existing systems, and that's clearly a catalyst for change. The second set of catalysts are government failures or political scandals. Certainly we've seen political scandal was prominent in both Italy and Japan. But government failure to a degree played a role in New Zealand and certainly played a role in Israel. That was the main reason why they tried to change their system. And you also have lesson learning. You've got one of those interesting cases where the new democracies are teaching the established democracies how to run their democracy. Not necessarily for the better, but in some ways, yes. I mean, new democracies change a lot of their administration of elections in some very beneficial ways, following the example of the new democracies. The establishment of electoral commissions, for example. That's quite a new trend. But lesson learning in terms of what I've been looking at here in the sense of the adoption of mixed systems. As you saw earlier on, mixed systems were quite prominent in many of the new democracies of Eastern Central Europe. Well, as we've seen here, mixed systems have also been prominent here in these established democracies. What about the goals or the objectives of electoral reform in these established cases? Well, clearly, all shared the goal of seeking to reduce the hold of dominant parties. I think it's fair to say that's what's going on behind all three of those cases, perhaps to varying degrees, but the desire to reduce the hold of the dominant parties, to allow some party competition to enter into the formation of government, for example. And then there were some quite specific goals. For Italy, it was to strengthen government stability. I mean, the phrase that was going around in Italy at that stage was, we want to become British. Now, for those of us living in Britain at the time, this is the early 1990s, having had 18 years of Conservative government, I'm married to a Labour politician, so I can be biased here. But for those of us living under 18 years of the same party in power again and again, we're sort of dramatically saying to them, don't do this, you don't want this. But nonetheless, that's what they seemed to want. They didn't get it, in some ways fortunately, in some ways not fortunately. But clearly, government stability is what they wanted. Italian governments, as you probably know, change on a monthly basis. Most of us change our government every 2 or 3 years. In Italy, they change them every couple of months. And that's roughly continued. Japan, it was to reduce candidate-based corruption. Their electoral system encouraged the candidates to chase funds in improper ways to try and fund their election campaigns. So they wanted to address that problem. And then in New Zealand, it was pretty much more a case of trying to open up the system, make it more available for other parties to break through. Now, whether all those sort of goals and other goals have been achieved is really a moot point. And I know Elizabeth will go into the New Zealand case in a lot more detail later on. So let me just touch on one or two things. I'm not going to say anything here about Japan, because as I've intimated, Japan really in many ways didn't change that dramatically. It was just another variant of the same system. But New Zealand and Italy are quite interesting here, I think. What you get is... I guess if I had to gloss over here, if I had to sort of put this in a very rudimentary and some aerial sense. I would say that the reforms seem to have worked roughly as anticipated in New Zealand, but they haven't in Italy. So it's kind of a mixed picture here. In the sense that you have more parties in New Zealand. If New Zealand moved from a non-proportional to a proportional system, it gets more parties. It gets more women in Parliament. It gets more ethnic minority seats in Parliament. In Italy, they were coming from a proportional system, moving in the opposite direction. They wanted to become British, remember? So they wanted to reduce the number of parties. No luck. They end up still being a multi-party system. In terms of government formation and government stability, New Zealand does move towards coalition government, as you might predict. And for the most part, it's been pretty successful. It's worked there in that sense. Good coalition government. Italy wanted to move away from unstable governments. It hasn't worked. I mean, okay, we got Berlusconi in power, but in the current prime minister, he's been there for, I think, the longest yet. I think he's the longest since Mussolini, somebody pointed out. But I won't say any more. But the point is that he is still not in a very stable situation. There's no guarantee he's going to be in government for much longer, so that could just be a blip. The governments are just as unstable in Italy as they've always been. And then are the changes popular? You make the change, what happens? Do the voters like it? Well, that's a difficult one. I mean, what happened in Italy was they felt, well, we haven't really become British enough. So very quickly after the development of the new Italian system, the voters petitioned again for another electoral system change, and they tried one more time to change the system to the full-blown single-member plurality British system. That didn't succeed for technical reasons. They didn't get enough votes, enough turnout. But it clearly suggests that it wasn't very popular in Italy. What about New Zealand? Because New Zealand has done some incredible detailed research on this. And this is a table I've taken straight from my own book, so some of you will have already have seen this. Now, this would suggest, on the face of it, that New Zealand voters aren't exactly enamoured by the new system. Before the referendum, the bulk of them preferred the mixed-member proportional system. Since the referendum, pretty consistently, it's been the other way around. I mean, there's a movement on the grass, but pretty consistently, they seem to prefer the old system, the system they got rid of. So at first blush, you might be correct. You might have a good reason to think, well, it hasn't worked. The voters don't particularly like it, so perhaps this was an error. Perhaps they shouldn't have changed the system. But of course, the problem is, how do we know that this is really telling us anything at all that's meaningful? How do we really know that this is measuring what it purports to know? How do we really know that it's measuring attitudes towards the electoral system, as opposed to attitudes towards politicians? Politicians are the least. I mean, in Britain, I don't know if it's the same in Canada. Estate agents are probably the most unpopular species, and then it's politicians, and then you work your way up. So politicians are extremely unpopular. So if you ask anything about politicians, you're going to get a negative response inevitably. We all blame our politicians. We all blame our governments. I may be being a bit cynical, but that's what the opinion polls show. And therefore, it's very difficult to get an accurate answer. If you go out and ask a voter, do you like your electoral system, they'll most likely give you the answer that they think you might expect them to give. That doesn't necessarily mean it's the answer that they really feel themselves that strongly about. So all I'm suggesting here is that while one might have an impression that the electoral system changes have not been terribly popular, one shouldn't read all that much into it. It's really difficult to get accurate information on this. And I don't doubt that if you change down the road and they do surveys, you'll get similar kind of things going on here. Now, that's enough about those three changes at national level. I did say I wanted to spend a bit of time looking at Britain, because I think Britain introduces some interesting points of comparison in terms of what's going on here. Britain went through quite an exciting period in the late 1990s. The 18 years of Tory rule finally ended. The Labour Party of Tony Blair got elected in 1997, and suddenly there was incredible change. Now, what I've got on the overhead there is the current state of play for the main electoral systems in use in the United Kingdom. There was no point doing this because it would have been a pointless exercise, but if I showed you what the situation was before 1997, well, half of those assemblies didn't exist. And in all cases where there were elections, it was single-member plurality. So with the one exception of the House of Commons, we have new systems. And Britain, the United Kingdom, today is in the proud position, I think probably the unique position, of using every single family of electoral systems. It's quite an achievement, and it's produced a lot of interesting research for those of us who like these things. So what about, you know, causes and objectives and consequences? What's behind all of this? Well, what's behind it is party tactics. What happens is the Labour government took a long time to get into government, 18 years. And so they went through a sort of road to Damascus kind of conversion, having started 20 years ago as being extremely pro single member plurality. Gradually, they began to see the virtues of the single member of proportional representation. They began to see the virtues, if for no other reason, that if they were to go out of power again, they might have a greater chance of getting back in a bit sooner than after 18 years. They also saw the use of these experimentations with new systems as a way of sort of shoring up the support of the Liberal Democratic Party. Because before the 1997 election, Tony Blair didn't know if he was going to win. I know it may seem bizarre if any of you watched the election count. I don't know if it was televised here, because he won big time. But he wasn't sure. It had taken 18 years, after all. So he was banking on the possibility that he might have to form a coalition government with the small Liberal Democratic Party. And so he was willing to say, OK, we're going to give you some electoral reform at regional level if you sort of, you know, look upon us as potential coalition partners. Another cause here was the establishment of regional assemblies. One of the big planks of the Labour Party platform in 1997 was the establishment of new regional parliaments, regional assemblies. And inevitably they would discuss new electoral systems for those. And then I suppose a final issue here is wanting to engage more constructively with Europe. As you may know, the traditional relationship between the United Kingdom government and the European Union is not exactly plain sailing. Britain is seen as one of the awkward partners within the European Union. Well, it was quite an easy device for the Labour government to say, OK, we're going to show our European credentials by changing the system we use to elect our members of the European Parliament to the same system that everyone else is using in the European Union. So that was quite a neat trick, really. Well, what were the objectives? What were they trying to achieve with these various changes? Well, for the most part, they were really based on pretty narrow leadership calculations. That's the summary, leadership calculations. And let me sort of put a bit of flesh on that. What was going on here was, let's think about it. We're in government now. We're the most popular party in 1997. But we're going to face elections. And these, to use the jargon, are known as second-order elections, elections to regional assemblies, or elections to the European Union, for example. The second order in the sense that they're not elections to change your government. They're sort of midterm tests of government. And as you know, in all countries, wherever you have midterm elections, the elections other than your general election, it's a very useful opportunity for the voters to kick the government in the backside, to sort of say, you know, wake up, we don't like what you're doing. We may still vote for you in the next general election, but we're going to give you a bit of a black eye now. And so it was seen as quite a useful device to try and cushion the Labour government by introducing proportional representation systems for all these new midterm tests, to try and cushion them so that they wouldn't be completely destroyed in those elections. There were other things going on. I just draw your attention to the election for the London mayor, AV, alternative vote. This is this majoritarian system. You're electing one person, so it has to be a majoritarian system. But it's a particular kind of alternative vote system they designed. I think I'm right in saying that only the state of Queensland used this in the 1880s. And apart from the state of Queensland in the 1880s, nobody else has used this particular version of the alternative vote. And why? It was for one very simple reason, and I don't know how much you know about local politics in Britain, probably not a lot, understandably, but if you ever heard the name Ken Livingstone, now, Ken Livingstone was somebody that Tony Blair did not want to win that election. So everything was being done to make sure he didn't win the election, including the way they designed the electoral system. Unfortunately, Ken Livingstone went on to win the election big time and is now a very happy member of the Labour Party again. He's become Tony Blair's best friend. But that was a clear party leadership calculation. And then in the case of the European Parliament system, the objective there, the list system, my wife is a member of that august institution, they brought in the closed list system to elect British MEPs, as opposed to, for example, the open list system. Why did they do that? They did that to control the MEPs. Because if you want to keep your seat in the European Parliament under the British system for electing their members, you've got to be pretty good. You've got to be, you know, a good player, because you have to get ranked as high as possible on that list. Whereas in an open list system, you might be more inclined to be a bit more independent. So they clearly were making sure they were going to control their MEPs. I think the one case where higher objectives other than leadership calculation came into play was with the system for Northern Ireland, the use of the single transferable vote. And why I say that is because there's historic reasons why Northern Ireland in the past has used that system for its own particular elections. And there was a sense that they could use a single transferable vote to try and encourage cross-community collaboration. You know, the possibility that the IRA Sinn Féin leadership might come in from the cold, and the extreme unionists under Ian Paisley might moderate their policies. All of those kind of things. So there were higher order things going on in the case of Northern Ireland, but that was pretty exceptional. What about the consequences? Well, the consequences were mixed. The good point is, I suppose, the voters were not confused. I mean, the fact that if you live in Scotland at present, you use a single member plurality system to elect your local council, you use the mixed system to elect your parliament, you use the closed list system to elect your member of the European Parliament, and you use, again, the single member plurality system for electing your member of the House of Commons. You might have anticipated an element of confusion is going to creep in for the unfortunate voter, but on the whole, that hasn't happened. The level of invalid voting has not been particularly high. So that's a pretty good thing. And for the most part, the voters seem reasonably satisfied, I think it's fair to say. So what evidence we can get on this seems to suggest it's worked for the voters. It's also worked in the sense that you get more parties. We're dealing with proportional systems. You're going to get more parties in these systems. So that's been pretty good. It's also had some success in terms of the formation of coalition government. Coalition government now happens in the United Kingdom. You know, the mother of the single party majority government system now has a coalition government in Scotland. Scotland is a coalition government. The government of Scotland is done by a coalition. And then in terms of the mixed systems, you have the question of whether there are two classes of politicians. And that's perhaps one of the unforeseen or unanticipated consequences. And that's been particularly notable in Scotland and Wales, which is why I drew your attention in the blue box to that. What you have is politicians on the constituency election not necessarily working in the same way as politicians elected on the list election. They may be from the same party. That isn't always the case. They're not working in the same way. And that's a bit unusual. That's not something that would have been anticipated. Now, I know we're going to hear more about that from Elizabeth later on, so I won't dwell on that point. Now, before leaving the British case, I just want to, you know, here we see the change, what's happened, the exciting thing for those of us who work in this area. There was one other area that was explored, and that was the House of Commons. That wasn't ignored, because Tony Blair, in the lead-up to the 1997 election and in his effort to try and encourage the Liberal Democrats to see them as a nice party, did sort of raise the issue of a possible new electoral system for electing members of the House of Commons, the system that has been in place, you know, for hundreds of years, effectively. So what about House of Commons reform? What the Labour Party had promised in 1997 was that they were going to establish a process for electoral reform in two parts. What they said was they were going to establish an independent commission, not a royal commission, not a meeting of party politicians, an independent commission. And the job of that commission would be to draw up a specification for a new electoral system. And once it had done that, the 1997 Labour Party platform promised that that would be put before the people in a referendum. So in 1997, everyone's very excited, because we have the possibility of change. We're going to have a referendum campaign. And so they duly follow through with the first part of their promise. The commission is established, the independent commission, which became known as the Jenkins Commission, under the chairmanship of the late Roy Jenkins, former very, very senior politician. But a Liberal Democratic politician, not a politician from Tony Blair's party. Now, unfortunately, one begins to see creeping in here the element of control. Labour government aren't quite going down the route you're going down here. Because what they do, first of all, is they set four very specific criteria for the commission. They make it very clear to the commission that they must consider these four criteria in any electoral system that they are likely to design. Broad proportionality, the extension of voter choice, stable government, and the constituency link. That last thing refers to the link between an individual MP and a geographical constituency of some kind or another. And why I put them in different coloured boxes is because it was pretty apparent from the beginning that there's a bit of tension built into this between a sort of tendency towards proportional representation and a tendency not towards proportional representation. It's a bit of tension. And in effect, what poor old Roy Jenkins and his independent commission were being asked to do was to square a circle. And that is why, I don't know if you've heard the adage about what is a camel? A camel is a horse that was designed by a committee. And in a sense, that's what we get. We get a camel. The Jenkins Commission deliberates over 8, 9, 10 months or something, an extremely fascinating process to follow, and produces this dramatic report which proposed a brand new system for the United Kingdom called Alternative Vote Plus. In effect, what this is a version of a mixed system. But as you can see in the yellow box there, it's quite a mixed system. It's a mix of three electoral systems in one. It's quite an achievement, and this is the squaring of the circle. So you've got a mix of the German mixed system, a mix of constituencies and lists, the Belgian ordered list systems, because the list element would be elected in a rank order election, so it's an element of open lists there, and the Australian alternative vote system for constituency seats, that the individual constituency politicians would have to get majoritarian results. Now, I think why I wanted to sort of draw your attention to this episode because I think it is important for at least two reasons. First of all, it shows how much the established political elite can seek to control the process of change. I mean, in this case, they seek to control the process of change both at the start by establishing these four criteria and at the finish. Why I say that at the finish is because what happened next was nothing. What happened next was, you remember I said earlier on that the Labour government, Labour Party platform had promised that once the Independent Commission had reported, there would be a referendum. Hasn't been a referendum. The Jenkins report is gathering dust very, very quickly, and there's no sign of it ever emerging in reality. So clearly there's tight control of the process at the very start and at the very finish, in the sense that they just close it down completely. But I think the second lesson, the salutary lesson, I think, is just how complex electoral reform can become. And I certainly think for your process that's something to really be given, I'm sure you already are, giving serious thought to. Because here you have a camel. Now, you might have had a camel simply because of the extraordinary criteria that you don't have to work within. But in essence, what was also going on was a sense that, and the Jenkins Commission report makes this very clear, that they wanted to be seen to be coming up with something new. They didn't want a bespoke system, a system that they just pull off the pegs that somebody else is using and say, here we go, we'll use this one. They wanted to be seen to be producing something dramatically new. And this is an example of where if you try too hard, you may not necessarily succeed. Okay, that's enough on the established systems. And I want to spend a little less time. I really don't have an awful lot to say. Okay, I want to sort of wrap up then in terms of, you know, what have we learned from this? Well, choosing new systems. What is the catalyst for change? Clearly, the catalyst for change is some kind of system shock. That's pretty obvious. In all cases, it's scandal, it's crisis, or it's an element of feeling jaded about the whole process and in an inappropriate election result. There are other aspects in the detail, and I don't have time to go into it now, so I won't spend too much time on that. But clearly, the context is different for proportional systems than it is for non-proportional systems. In terms of choosing new systems, the process of reform, I think it's very clear that it can be helpful to allow voters to have a sense of ownership of the process. But there are very few examples of where that has happened. There's only a handful of cases of where the voters have had any ownership of the process. We've seen it happened to a degree in Italy. It's happened to a degree in New Zealand. It happened in Scotland and Wales. And very quickly you run out of examples. There's very few other examples of where the voters were able to have a say in the design of the system of some kind or another. The sort of issues to consider. What are the issues to consider in electoral system design? Well, here are the obvious ones that come up again and again and again. Government stability, the need to incorporate minorities, the question of the link between politicians and voters, and whether you need to keep it simple. And if we take those four points and apply it to your average electoral system, and I know you've looked at electoral systems already in terms of these three main features, district magnitude, electoral formula, and ballot structure, you can begin to see how one can fill the boxes out. And this is a highly simplistic attempt to do it here, completely inappropriate. I mean, for example, what on earth do you mean by stability? Here I'm sort of assuming that stability means single-party government. You could have a completely different definition of stability. So I'm not suggesting for a moment that these boxes are filled out correctly. And there's also the bugbear of trade-offs. The problem that you may have conflicting or potentially conflicting objectives here. And here are a couple of the more obvious ones. You may want a highly proportional, you may want a proportional system, but at the same time, you may want what you might consider to be a stable system, which might be a single-party government. How do you marry those two things? And that's perhaps one big reason why we've ended up with so many examples of mixed-member majoritarian systems, because the people designing those systems say this seems to be the best of both worlds. You can get your proportionality and your stability at the same time. I don't really think that's the correct answer, that you have to use those systems for that. There are other systems that can achieve that. And then there's also a bit of a trade-off between proportionality and the constituency link. Because if you think of proportionality in terms of the continental European closed-list system, for example, the list system, you're not going to get much constituency link there. So how do you marry those two things? And that's very often, again, why you get people talking about mixed systems, which is a bit unfortunate because you could just as easily talk about the Finnish open-list system or the single transferable vote system or other systems that can deal with that kind of trade-off. Very quickly, I'm nearly there. Have the new systems worked as expected? I'm just quickly pick out one or two things from what I've been saying. On the one hand, yes, they have worked as anticipated, in the sense that when you've moved to a proportional system, you've had proportional election results. Pretty obvious. You've got more minorities. You've got more. You've got better gender balance in your parliament. They've also worked in the sense that politicians and voters quickly learn how to use the systems. You don't have many invalid votes. Politicians learn how to campaign in the systems, so they're clearly functioning systems. But in many other respects, and this again is just a flavour, they haven't always worked as anticipated. There have been unanticipated consequences, and you'll hear more about those later. As shown by Italy and in a couple of other places we've seen in Central and Eastern Europe, where they quickly want to change the system. That would suggest that it perhaps hasn't worked as anticipated. And I think in the detail of the mixed systems, there's some unanticipated consequences in many of the countries that have adopted those systems in terms of the development of two classes of MPs and whether that is necessarily a good thing for your system. And why I draw your attention to that is because that might, as I tried to be suggesting here, lead to a question mark over whether the mixed system is really the system everyone should always be thinking about. Is it really the only option? So to conclude, because I want to try and leave a bit of time for questions. All I want to say in the conclusion is the obvious point that what we're going through here, what you're going through here, is utterly unique. I have no idea of anywhere else that has done anything remotely like what you're doing. Okay, there have been other cases we've seen where the electoral reform has occurred in an existing democracy, New Zealand, Israel, Japan, all of those. We've seen that before, so you're not the first to do that. We've seen other cases where the final decision is given to voters in a referendum of some kind or another. You're not the first in that, assuming you propose change and assuming you then go for a referendum. What you are unique in is in those last two points. You are unique in having established a process where there's no pre-set criteria. You have a blank sheet. That's never happened before, and I really hope it happens again. And secondly, finally, you have a situation where the proposed alternative system is going to be designed by you, by your process, not by the established elite. And that, for me, is, as I said, a reason why anoraks of the world are so excited. Thank you.
David, that was a marvelous review, and we particularly like your comments about the process which we're engaged. We will have questions. Mary's going to help me track. Julie.
First question is really, I'm curious about something. You were talking about Italy, and I was curious as to what mechanism is in place or was in place for Italian voters to instigate the process of an abrogated referendum, and in what way was it abrogated? And the second is a question with reference to the consequence of the changes to electoral systems. And I'm wondering, with regard to some of the countries, Japan, Italy, are some of these consequences as much reflective of the flavor of the individual societies as anything else? And is it maybe a bit too soon to really come to a conclusion with regard to those consequences?
Yes. I mean, there's a lot in those questions, so you'll forgive me if I don't go into sufficient detail to answer them adequately. But on your first one, there's just a particular detail about how the Italian political system operates that allows for a petition for a referendum. And that is, in some ways, relatively unique. In my own country, in Ireland, voters have no option, no way in which they can force a referendum. And what had happened, just in the basic point, is that over the years, in the post-war years, the size of the parliament had increased. And to facilitate that, they had adapted the existing legislation to allow for a 25% increase in the number of senators. And the way in which the legislation had been drawn up was such that by deleting a few little bits here and there, you could effect a change so that those 25% of your Senate would be elected in lists, and the other 75% would be elected in constituencies. So it's just a quirk of how the legislation had been drafted historically. And, you know, they were very lucky that they had that option, but it's not likely that that will ever occur again in other systems. As for your question about the sort of, if I understand the sort of general idea, is whether the system that is finally adopted in any of these cases was necessarily the most appropriate for their cultural circumstances.
I was referring to the consequences, the fact that there, in some cases, didn't appear to be any change. And I was wondering if that was reflective simply because, for example, Italy has a particular flavor, and whether yes. that flavor is going to go away with the change in an electoral system.
Yes. I mean, this is a fact. You can never predict the way the change is going to go. You have no way of knowing that the electoral system used in country A is going to be used in the same way in country B. And just to give you an illustration, you know, where I come from in Ireland, our politicians are not exactly the best politicians under this earth. We're very good at big city politics, you know, constituency casework and all of that. And people blame the electoral system for that. But I'd bet you, bottom dollar, that if they change to a completely different system, you get exactly the same politicians.
Thank you. Neil.
Pass.
Alan.
Thank you. In these referendums for approval in New Zealand, what was their threshold, one? And in your experience looking at the changes to mixed systems, has it actually increased the amount of parliamentary democracy in the open as opposed to behind closed doors?
On the first one, I'm going to defer to Elizabeth, who's somewhere in this room. But my understanding is that for New Zealand, there was no threshold.
No, the simple majority of those who turned out to vote.
The simple majority of those who turned out to vote. So that was sufficient, and it was quite a close result in the second referendum, I believe. As for whether there was any kind of change in the way of opening up the political process. I know that we'll hear more about New Zealand there, and that's where the best evidence is available. I'm not aware of an awful lot of that in the other systems, but I think in large part that's because there hasn't been nearly the wealth of research by political scientists that there has been on the New Zealand case. So I'm guessing you'll get a far better answer to your question this afternoon.
RB.
Thank you. I'd like to ask, I have some questions here, but given the time, Jack, you can help me where I can stop. Now, first question is about proportionality and government stability. It is generally believed that PR systems fail to produce stable governments. And countries like Israel, you were saying the importance of stability. In your book, you show that Switzerland has the longest average government duration of 8.59 years. What is the secret of success in this case? what is that Switzerland is doing, what other peer list countries don't do? That's my first question.
Okay, that's a great question. In a sense, it sort of gets back to one of the earlier questions I was addressing. A lot of it is, in a lot of cases, the electoral system is neither here nor there, in a lot of cases. It's got a lot more to do with the political culture. It's got a lot more to do with the institutions of how your parliament operates, for example. For example, in Italy, for a very long time, MPs voted by secret ballot when they made parliamentary votes. So it's very easy for a backbench MP to vote against his or her party leader because there was no way of knowing which way he or she voted. So it had less to do with the electoral system, the instability, and more to do with how the parliament operated. So I guess my answer to your question is it isn't necessarily the case that moving towards multi-party democracy will produce instability. On the whole, and I know I'm not alone in saying this, the coalition governments have a better record. They're more stable, they have better public policy output, and they on the whole tend to be more popular. So stability is enhanced by moving towards multi-party politics.
My second question, Mr. Chairman, please allow me to continue. My understanding is in most democracies, the legislature needs more than 50% plus one majority to make some more important decisions. Like, for an example, to change the constitution. In some countries, you need at least two-thirds majority. This is the British system. In most of the former Commonwealth countries, you get this system.
Yes.
Now, with the peer system, it can become very difficult to enjoy that kind of majority support in the legislature. I know how this situation has brought up a political crisis, at least in one country, Sri Lanka, after establishing a peer system in 1978. This will happen to many other former British colonies too.
Yes.
Does this mean peer governments have no chance or very little chance in making such important changes in the future?
I don't think so, and it's a very fair question to ask. My sense is that if you're dealing with a political system that might have an inclination to be unstable, perhaps through ethnic or deep regional divisions in that country, then one would be well advised when thinking about electoral reform to also think about wider institutional reform, so that your electoral system is embedded in a set of political institutions that helps it to work. And I don't know if British Columbia would fit a category of being a province that might become unstable if you went down the road for a proportional system, let's say. But it might be worth considering that if you were going down a road like that, whether the rules of how your parliament operates, for example, might need also to be considered.
Thank you, RB. Sally?
It's not really a question, but I've been thinking about this for so long. While we are having our study and learning, we go into different changes and experimentation. The countries that we are studying, they go into different stages of changes and experimentation. That is what we cannot afford here in British Columbia, because the electorate will blame the citizen assembly if our recommendation will pass the referendum, and we are not giving the answer of the needs of the electorate. So this is, I don't know, I'm a little bit confused now. If we are going to be able to set the goals and selecting our electoral system, that is very good for British Columbia. I think we have to discuss and learn what the needs really of our government. I can see that there are good system in the other countries, but the problem is we should address the problem of British Columbia so we can be able to get the mandate of this citizen assembly.
Yes, I mean, my good friend and colleague Richard Katz from Johns Hopkins University, who is a big specialist in the area of electoral systems, at the conclusion to his last book, he raises the rhetorical question, if asked, what is the best electoral system for your country, what answer should you give? And his answer is, it depends. And that's it. There's just no way of giving a simple answer. And you're far best placed than anybody else, because you come from British Columbia, to determine what's best for your province.
Thank you. David, we've got about 10 questioners, so we're going to go through these pretty quickly. So perhaps additional hands we might not be able to recognize. David?
Hi there. Could you tell us that you said that in the Eastern Europe there were three countries that moved in to 2002 to a list system from different systems? These were Bulgaria, Croatia, and Estonia. Did they move to open or closed lists? Do you know?
I don't know. One of the facilitators was asking me when we had a sort of pre-meeting, in case this was to come up in the discussion groups. And unfortunately, the information available is so hard to get. So all I have is what I had on the slide about the case of preferential voting, but I don't know about how preferential or when they changed or if they changed from something else. I can't answer that.
If I may, a second question. You seem to... You talked about a problem of two classes of MPs in mixed systems. Can you elaborate on what some of those problems have been?
Yes, I mean, this is it can come down to relatively seemingly mundane things, like in Scotland, do you give the same parliamentary allowance to run an office to an MP who's not elected from a single constituency? And then what happens if the MP in that constituency suddenly discovers another office is somehow being established by a list MP who happens to live in the same town? You know, the element of competition between the two individual legislators. To what extent do they pay attention to the needs of their voters? List MPs, you know, their basis for election is how highly ranked they are on the list, not how many drains they've had cleared. So it's that kind of tension. And I know Elizabeth's going to say more about it than I'm doing here, but that's the sort of issue that's arisen. And you don't get that in other electoral systems.
Thank you. Darren?
Thank you. I was wondering if you could comment on why the Jenkins recommendation continues to gather dust, as you said. I'm wondering, was the proposal seen as too complicated for voters and then never embraced by the public, or was it killed politically or for some other reason?
I mean, I would like to think it was the former, but in fact, the public didn't pay it any attention whatsoever. So the reason it didn't work was for political reasons. The Labour government elected in 1997 did even better in 2002, 2001, whenever the next election was. So they just didn't need it anymore. They did the classic thing of thinking in terms of short-term interests. But there's no doubt if they had decided to take it forward for a referendum, the first question that would be raised is, why is this so complex? Because it's more complex than any other system around, I think. Maybe Hungary can compete. But
thank you.
George.
Thank you. David asked the same question as I wanted to ask, and I'm happy with the answer. Thank you.
Thank you. Jack?
Thanks. Just on Jenkins again, I mean, you're right in saying that the criteria that are in our mandate are much broader. We have to come forward with a recommendation that is consistent with the Canadian Constitution and the Westminster parliamentary system, which is pretty broad.
Yes.
But the four tests that were in Jenkins, even though they were constraining because it was his formal mandate, seemed to bear a close resemblance to the sorts of issues or factors that we're taking into account and weighing various alternative systems.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering if you think that applying those sorts of issues, which struck me as being pretty reasonable ones for our mandate as well, would necessarily result in a camel that couldn't walk.
Hmm? Yeah, it's a very fair point. I mean, I've obviously had to sort of gloss over some things here. I think what many of us were concerned about was, on the one hand, the criteria seemed quite restrictive. They're a lot less restrictive than the New Zealand case, for example. On the other hand, the way in which the Jenkins Commission decided to interpret those criteria, and in a sense, he had probably no choice, he probably had to interpret it this way. But, for example, how you define stable government. For them, that was single-party government. For example, how you just define the constituency link. For them, that meant individual MPs per constituency. Seemed a bit unfortunate. So that on one level, those criteria might look very good, but I think it really comes down to how you interpret them.
Fred?
My question was asked by someone else, and it was answered, and I thank you very much.
Thank you, Fred.
Rob.
Thank you. Two-part question. With regards to the cases of New Zealand, Japan, and Italy, pardon me, all occurring within a very short span, was that due to the economic situation in the world at the time? As I recall, it was the world economy was kind of diving a little bit at that time, or were there other factors? And with regards to the countries that did switch from a plurality system with a single member to a list system, how was your sense of how the constituents kind of felt about losing their individual member? Thank you.
I'm not able to give very good answers to those questions, which are absolutely spot on, but I just don't know enough information on it. My understanding is that in the case of Japan and Italy, it was less to do with the economic downturn and just fury with the politicians. You know, the process was corrupt and had to be changed. Why then and then nothing else since is just one of those imponderables. You know, those of us right in the early 1990s were, you know, licking our lips because we thought there's going to be a lot more of this. This is great. And then it just sort of dissipated. And it's just one of those imponderables. As for how the voters have reacted to the loss of the to a dilution of the constituency link, I know that, again, that's something Elizabeth will say more about in New Zealand. And the degree of evidence from Japan and Italy is much more circumspect, so I can't really comment on those. So I'm guessing you'll hear more from her later on, if that's the best I can do.
Thank you very much. We're going to take just three more. Others put up their hands. We haven't been able to have the time, but remember that David will be with us this evening, and we can perhaps take our list with us this evening and give you first crack at David. That seems fair. Bill.
Thank you. In your presentation, you noted there was an average disproportion and a number of parties given for Eastern Europe. Can you give us an idea of the same number for the Italian, New Zealand, and Japanese systems? Do they have a higher or lower disproportionality and number of parties?
I can't. I don't have the figures to hand. I know there'll be in the textbook. There's a table in table seven in chapter seven that will probably give you your answers. I can just give you the averages. I have them here somewhere. At the same time, I'm not going to find it. What I can tell you is the headline, which is that the average proportionality was lower in the established democracies of Western Europe at that same time, and the average number of parliamentary parties was higher at that same time. So that's as I was trying to suggest, that there was an element of balancing out going on. But that's the best I can give you at this stage.
Thank you, Douglas.
I just want to have a clarification regarding minority systems. On our third weekend, Ken Carty, he told us that the minorities are not well represented under a majority system, you know, the small groups, the small parties. But yet on your sixth slide today, you were referring to majorities. A majority system facilitates minorities. So there's a contradiction there. I'd just like to have it clarified.
Yes. I'm not sure if I – what I meant to use that – unless I've said something wrong – facilitating minorities. Well, I was talking. I have to think about this one for a second.
It's okay. Go ahead and think about it. You can get back to us later on. It's okay.
Okay. I don't think I was trying to say that, but anyway, I could have said something wrong. I'll come back to you.
Margaret.
My question's been covered, but I will make a comment that, wow, I'm impressed with how sophisticated the questions have become over the weeks.
We have several questions, but we've recorded them, and this evening those RB, Gene, and Bob, and others will get first crack at David after dinner. David, this was a wonderful presentation and discussion, very helpful, very illuminating. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
David, by the way, oh, wow. David, by the way, this evening said he'd be happy and delighted to sign your books, okay? Coffee and then the discussion groups at 11. Thank you.